Sarah Palin is a ubiquitous cipher. She's the once obscure mayor of an obscure town who rose to become the governor of an obscure state, parlayed that position onto the presidential ticket. You know that much about her, but how much else do you know? She would argue that her past has been picked over and studied like a Dead Sea Scroll. But the Palin myth-making machine keeps churning out reality TV shows and Facebook postings that provide fresh texts. Enter Joe McGinnis, the renowned reporter. He moved to Alaska. He moved next to the Palins, in fact, in reporting his new book, The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. Joe McGinnis is here at WNYC. Thanks for coming in.
I'm glad to be here, Mike.
So in real estate, it's location, location, location. I never knew it was the same in journalism, but my gosh, did your choice of a rental home cause a Palin-stirred storm? Tell us, how'd you come to move next to the former governor?
It was a total fluke. I actually was about to sign a lease on an apartment in Anchorage for the summer. At 6 o'clock on a Thursday evening, and at 3 o'clock that afternoon, my Alaska cell phone rang, and I had just gotten back to Alaska, and this cell phone had been turned off the whole time I was out of the state. And during the months it was turned off, a woman named Catherine Taylor had been trying to call me. I had it turned back on, and I answered it, and it was Catherine Taylor. She told me how she got my number, and she said, "I've been trying to reach you because I heard that you were going to want to rent a place when you came back for several months to do more research." And she said, "I have a house in Wasilla." And I said, "Hey, that's interesting, because 80% of the people that I'm needing to talk to now are in or near Wasilla, and it would save me a 2-hour commute every day driving back and forth to Anchorage." So I said, where in Wasilla? And she said, "Well, actually, it's the house right next to Todd and Sarah." I said, "Oh, my goodness, you know, can I come up tomorrow and look at it?" And it was just an astonishing piece of good fortune.
Did you ever question, "Oh, maybe I want to get a break from this. Maybe I'll be putting out the wrong signal"?
I didn't see any signal I'm putting out. I'm getting a great sense of place. I looked at the same view she had, you know, from her deck to my deck, and I think that, you want to be as close to your subject as you can be without, and this is an important point, without invading anybody's privacy. And when Todd came over a couple of days after I'd moved in there to express dismay, because he knew who I was, he'd read a magazine article I'd written, that I was going to be living there, I said, "Well, you know, you don't have anything to worry about, because I'm actually a pretty good neighbor." I said, I'll be here, you know, I'll go my way, you go mine, you know, so just, he said, well, he got very indignant, and it's in the book, but he said, "Well, we'll just see how long you stay here." You know, they wanted to, they got aggressive right away, which offered me an insight into Sarah's character and Todd's that I otherwise wouldn't have gotten, so.
Well, in fact, the big deal she made about you moving next door and that this was picked up on talk radio and places, that became a framing device for your book. And in fact, the interplay that you had resulting from that showed a lot of the big themes that you were trying to illustrate. There was a little bit of the confrontation. What else did you glean from the fact that she was so upset about you moving next door?
Well, she has no sense of proportion. This was a minor annoyance. I could see if I can't quite imagine the situation being reversed, but I could see if somebody who I thought was doing work that was not going to redound to my benefit moved in right next door to me, I'd wish that that hadn't happened. But I think I would be an adult about it, and I would say, as long as you don't bother me, I'm just going to forget about this. Yeah. And actually, if she hadn't gone on Facebook and then gone on with Glenn Beck and other people and complained about it and gotten hysterical, nobody even would have known about it, because we never had any interactions. But the fact that she got so angry and that she would make up lies.
That you were looking directly into her daughter's window.
Yes, yeah. Ridiculous, you know, victimizing them. I heard things about this. I'd heard that Sarah had these traits, but to experience them firsthand, of course, that's the best way. That's immersion. And she really immersed me in her ability to stir up hate by telling vicious lies about people.
Now, I know person after person who expressed support for your project, or what they thought your project would be, offered you handguns, but did it ever get to the point where it was really scary?
Well, I never left, let's put it that way.
Right.
It was pretty, it's unpleasant. I'll just say it's unpleasant to receive a steady stream of death threats. And when they start to threaten my wife, and it got so far as they threatened my grandchildren.
And you told them to cancel the trip.
I said, Susie, I can't let you bring the kids out here because, you know, people are saying they should buy a one-way ticket because those kids are going to find their bodies floating in the lake. I mean, this is sick stuff. And this was before Gabrielle Giffords, you know, so we've seen it later play out. But in real life, but even this past week, there's a guy has a website, a right-wing website, who linked to SARAPAC, the Political Action Committee, and said he's raising money to donate to Todd's legal fund to pay Todd's legal fees after he's arrested for seeking me out and beating me up so badly that I have to be hospitalized. You know, this is, Sarah incites hatred, and that hatred among her people can easily turn to violence, so it's something you're constantly aware of.
You have worked in, shall we say, different strains of the journalistic tradition. You were a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You wrote the great book, The Selling of the President, made your name with that groundbreaking book that anyone who covers politics has to read. But this book is a little different in terms of sourcing. So I say to you, without this being accusatory, what is the standard for the veracity of the facts or the statements or the assertions made in the book?
Well, there are probably, I haven't counted them up, Mike, but flipping through it, I think there are about 75 named sources in the book. There are a handful of people whose names I had to leave out of the book because they were afraid of the reaction they would face if they were quoted as saying certain things. Sarah instills an atmosphere of fear. It's endemic throughout the Wasilla area. This has been going on since she was mayor. She tries to have it both ways. She intimidates people into refusing to talk about her on the record, and then when they talk about her off the record, she says, oh, look at that, anonymous sources. Well,
or when they talk about her on the record, they become someone with an axe to grind.
That's right. And already I've heard from a couple of people who've talked about her on the record who have been told, you better watch your back. Todd and Sarah are not happy. You're going to hear about this. And, you know, another thing, Mike, is that There's a great and noble tradition of anonymous sources in journalism. Look at Deep Throat, Woodward and Bernstein. You know, they kept that source anonymous for 40 years. Every day in the New York Times, the Washington Post, you'll read stories where so-and-so was quoted anonymously, name not given, because he wasn't authorized to speak on behalf of such and such. It's standard practice. And what set it apart up there was the very real reasons people had for being afraid of the Palins. These people can be vicious, and it's a small town. And I didn't want to get any. Well, obviously, if I told someone I would keep them anonymous, I did that because you have to protect your sources.
This is Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org, speaking with Joe McGinnis, author of The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. Well, on the issue of anonymous sources, yes, it is they are used by all sorts of journalistic organizations. Recent studies just show that actually their uses are declining. I think when the New York Times or NPR, which tries not to use anonymous sources except in rare instances when they use them, there are rules that the reader knows. For instance, you know, the New York Times is communicating everything that's been put in the mouth of an anonymous source has somehow been confirmed some other way, and NPR tries to do the same thing. So you read this book and you come across phrases like a friend says, an acquaintance says, an attractive white woman says, one former house guest says. Is it enough? Was it enough that they said it, or is every time there a quote in the book an effort made to confirm that beyond the anonymous source?
Every statement made by a source in the book, whether named or not named, was something that I've confirmed with other people. That's why it took such a long amount of time for me to do my reporting up there and to write the book. I kept working on this even after I left by telephone, checking things out, confirming things. There were many, many, many things that I was told by people that I couldn't confirm or verify to my own satisfaction, and you won't find them in The Rogue.
If there is a quote in the book even attributed to an anonymous source, Do you stand by not just that that person maintains that, or do you stand by the fact that, to the best of your knowledge, that thing that the person is asserting actually happened?
Actually happened.
Okay. Perhaps the biggest revelation that got widespread attention outside of the political media was this small part of the book where it said that Glenn Rice, the former great basketball player for the University of Michigan, slept with Sarah Palin. The New York Times, in their review, had a problem with that reporting. They said Mr. McGinnis eggs Glenn Rice on with the kind of flagrantly leading question he seems to have habitually asked in Mr. Rice's case. So you never had any feeling she felt bad about having sex with a black guy? But what the New York Times review perhaps doesn't get into is, was that the only question where you confirmed that Glenn Rice had slept with Sarah Palin? Did he confirm it apart from his answer to that question?
Yes, it's been confirmed. In fact, Glenn just got a copy of the book. He called me, today's Monday. He called on Saturday and said he read the parts about him. He said, it's good. It's all good. And there was never any question about this. The story that I heard is interesting because this is what led to this. I don't, you know, the fact that it turned out to be Glenn Rice, well, you know, I had no way of knowing that Sarah had slept with a guy who later got to be famous. The story I heard was, you know, racism is a strong undercurrent throughout her career. There's been overtly and covertly a racist tinge to her appeal. When she became governor, one of the first acts of her administration was to fire a couple of dozen low and mid-level state employees simply because they were black. And she said to her chief of staff, these people make me uncomfortable. Her father actually remembers when she dropped out of the University of Hawaii at Hilo after only 3 weeks. He said, her own father said, it was kind of a minority thing and Sarah wasn't comfortable. There's always been this discomfort around people of color. How in the world then does she find herself in bed with a black man? And was that a bad experience? Did she have a bad reaction afterwards? The first story that I heard from a number of people was that it was the way she freaked out afterwards. It was not a big event, but then afterwards, for days, she was going around saying, oh, my God, I can't believe I did that. I feel so, this is awful. She was hysterical about this. So I wanted to find out who the man was because I just don't want to print that unless I can find out the other half, you know. And for months and months and months, I tried to find the identity of who this might have been. It's a long story, which I'm some of it I can't talk about because it involves confidential sources. But in the end, I found out that it was Glenn Rice. So I got in touch with Glenn and I said, how do you remember this? Because I'm told that Sarah had a bad reaction, that she couldn't believe she'd had sex with a black man. You know, do you recall this as having been? He said, no. Nothing like that. He said it was all good. In fact, we stayed in touch by phone for months afterward. He said I had kind of a crush on her. And, whoever told you that, that's just flat out wrong. Glenn Rice is a very classy guy, and he was never going to, you know, he would never have talked about this if I hadn't asked him the particular question. Did she freak out afterwards because she'd had sex with a black man? And he laughed, and he said, not unless it was somebody else, because not with me. You know, we had a really fine time, and I remember it fondly. I still do. He thinks very highly of Sarah, and he's made that very clear.
Reviewers, people who have read the book, have questioned, why is that anecdote even in the book? You just explained why. And then they said, you know, would this have been written about a male candidate? Would it have been news that they had a sexual liaison while not married?
Well, if a male candidate had a sexual liaison with Glenn Rice, I certainly think it would have been news.
If Glenn confirmed it, yeah. Although, you know, okay, so that story does a couple things. I think it probably, one of the criticisms of the book is this is all scurrilous innuendo and it's unconfirmed. Well, at least that was Glenn Rice confirming it, so that's to your credit.
Actually, there isn't any innuendo.
There's a little innuendo.
Innuendo is hints. Mm-hmm. These are not hints. People tell me things and I wrote them down.
Well, I think if we look at the chapter on Trigg's pregnancy, on Sarah's pregnancy and if she really did give birth to Trigg, there are passages in there which, well, let's back up. You say that, if I'm quoting you correctly, you didn't and don't believe that Sarah Palin faked her pregnancy.
I'm a Trigg-gnostic. I just don't know the truth about that question. And so I present in chapter 19 I state that this is a legitimate question. Andrew Sullivan has been one of the very few people who's continued to even think of it as a legitimate question. Mainstream media has refused to even look into this. And there are reasons why it's difficult to believe the story that Sarah told about the pregnancy and the flight back to Alaska and the birth of Trigg. I don't answer those questions. I present what Sarah said. I present what skeptics have said. I talk about the questions that are still unanswered, and I make no hypotheses.
You say, it is perhaps the most blistering assessment of her character possible that many Wasilans who'd known Sarah from high school onward told me that even if she had not faked the entire story of her pregnancy and Trigg's birth, it was something she was eminently capable of doing. I don't know if that is the definition of innuendo, but that,
no,
I don't think
not,
that's fair.
It's not innuendo. Actually, it is fair, Mike,
okay.
Because I expected when I began to ask people about, you know, there's these stories that she's not really Trigg's mother. I expected that the people who've known her best and longest would say, well, that's outrageous. That's ridiculous. That's preposterous. Over and over again, to my amazement, I heard people say, well, you know, that could be because, you know, that's not beyond Sarah. That's certainly, you know, Sarah could certainly have done something like that. That was a shocking revelation that the people who've known her longest felt that she was capable of something so outrageous as faking a pregnancy.
Was this the people who knew her longest or the self-selecting group of people who knew her longest who spoke to you? Were there Sarah defenders in that group saying she could have done it?
Sarah's people who, Sarah told anybody who's on her side up there not to talk to me. It was hard to find people. I had the other big surprise to me last summer was how unpopular Sarah was in Wasilla. She had lost so much of her support. She had alienated so many people. I went up there expecting to find, sure, some disgruntled critics and a lot of people who still love Sarah. The people who still love Sarah are few and far between. Very, very few, Mike.
My last question about the agnosticism on the Trigg pregnancy question is, if you had changed that sentence from the people who knew her best thought she was capable of faking the pregnancy, if you changed that to the people that knew Barack Obama best thought he was capable of faking the nation of his birth, you could probably read that sentence in some magazine somewhere. It just struck me as...
I don't, but you know what? I don't think the people who know Barack Obama best would say that he was capable.
Okay, fair enough. I'm speaking with Joe McGinnis about his book, The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. It's published by Crown, and we'll be back with more after a break.
I passed out and nearly drowned. My sister David pulled me out. And I never saw Lynyrd Skynyrd, but I sure saw Molly Hatchet. The band that I was in played. The boys are back.
Hi, this is Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate, and the reason we played a song that said I never saw Lynyrd Skynyrd, but I saw Molly Hatchet, and that's by the Drive-By Truckers, is that Joe McGinnis, in his book The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin, revealed that Lynyrd Skynyrd and Molly Hatchet were two of her favorite bands in high school. So we got to that's the rock and roll. We got into some of the sex. I don't know if we'll get into some of the drugs. What I want to talk about is the religiosity, and there's a lot of reporting in this book, which could lead one to believe that she is irreligious and a hypocrite or hyper-religious. What's the real picture that you found?
I think she's a religious extremist, and I think she's a very dangerous religious extremist who would like to end the separation of church and state in the United States. I think she wants to make America into a Christian republic where Christians would have control of government and biblical law would replace our constitutional law as the law of the land. I think she's been on a crusade to bring this about since she first ran for mayor of Wasilla, even before that when she first tried to force the local hospital to illegally prohibit second trimester abortions. I think that's been a consistent strain throughout her life. I think she's at the extreme fringe of the Dominionist movement. She's not just an evangelical. She's a woman who believes in witches and had a pastor at her Assembly of God Church in Wasilla cast a spell on her to protect her from witches. She's been in touch with the James Dobson in Colorado Springs with the New Apostolic Reformation. She's hardcore, crazy extremist religious fanatic, I think, and everybody can have their own religion, and this is fine. But when you try to impose your religious beliefs on my country, this woman came within a few percentage points and a heartbeat of becoming president of the United States. And I don't think anybody understood this about her at that time, because I don't think the mainstream media did any kind of homework, any kind of digging into this aspect of her past and career.
If Barack Obama was hurt from his associations with his pastor, why then was the connection between Sarah Palin and Mary Glazer, who is the pastor you were talking about, why was that not gotten into? Was the connection really not that strong? Was Mary Glazer just someone who Sarah Palin only had a passing association with?
No, she's had the association. This was actually not a pastor, but the leader of a prayer group in Wasilla. And even before, when Sarah was simply a housewife in Wasilla, she joined this Mary Glazer prayer group. Mary Glazer, to give you a bit of flavor about her, is a woman who said that she drove a witch out of Alaska herself through focused prayer. There was a woman, an individual applied for the to become chaplain of the Alaska State Prison System. Mary Glazer didn't approve of this person and said that through her prayer group, they caused bad things to happen to this person. They caused cancer of the eye. A car blew up. The person finally had to leave Alaska to seek medical treatment. Mary Glazer claimed this as a great victory for her brand of Christianity. They were praying with Sarah Palin 2 years before she ran for mayor of Wasilla. And Mary Glazer said, "It became clear to us that God had chosen Sarah. God had anointed her to get into politics and to carry our principles forward." After Sarah was sworn in as governor, and this is how many years later? This is more than 10 years later. Mary Glazer spoke at a new apostolic reformation gathering in the Pacific Northwest. It was Oregon of the state of Washington. It's in the book. And she said, Sarah is going to turn Alaska over to Jesus now. This is governor. You know, we have separation of church and state. These people want to abolish it covertly, surreptitiously, gain positions of power, and then execute their coup, more or less. And I think this is probably the most important aspect of the book, is that I make clear in a way no one has before the extent to which Sarah is in the grip of these religious fanatics.
Has Sarah Palin been asked if she's had any contact with Mary Glazer since before she was mayor of Alaska, mayor of Wasilla?
Mary Glazer appeared at the governor's prayer breakfast when Sarah was governor.
And what does Sarah say about Mary Glazer today?
Sarah has never said anything other than she supports Mary Glazer and she appreciates Mary Glazer's support and the support of all the other, she's never repudiated any of these associations.
Do you think Sarah honestly believes, Sarah, listen to me, do you think that the former governor honestly believes that the earth is 6,000 years old, or does she just say that because she's talking to people who want to believe that?
Well, the person she first said that to, Phil Munger, is a progressive blogger in Alaska and also a music professor at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And Phil is not a professed Christian evangelical. He asked Sarah that question at a graduation ceremony for an Assembly of God church school program. And he said, "Sarah, my wife has heard that you believe the earth is really only 6,000 years old. Is that literally true, or is that just some sort of exaggeration?" Phil was quite skeptical about this. And she said, no, that's true. I am a new earth creationist, and you may not understand this, but, you know, Jesus is coming back to us during my time here on earth, and that governs my every action in public life. And you may not understand it, but it's true, Phil." So she wasn't talking to the converted. She was actually talking to the unconverted, and she wasn't trying to persuade him, but she was back in the Wasilla High School days when they would go on school athletic trips. She would come back. The girls were in the front of the bus, and the boys were in the back of the bus, and Sarah would come to the back of the bus with religious pamphlets from the Assembly of God and saying, "You have to bring Jesus into your souls." These guys were playing poker and reading Playboy magazine, and Sarah was trying to preach religion to them. This has been a steady... She joined this church. She was active in this church, the Assembly of God, from the second grade onward, she was part of a group called the Missionettes, which were young girl missionaries mm-hmm. being trained to go door to door to spread the word of the gospel. This has been there throughout her life.
Among the other on-the-record sources that you spoke to is Lyda Green. Am I saying it
Lyda,
right?
That's correct.
L-Y-D-A, Lyda Green, former president of the Alaska Senate. She's a former,
that's right. Yeah, she was former, the state Senate president.
What did she have to... Now she would be one of those people the Palins would call someone with an axe to grind. She's not unknown in the public record, but what does she have to say about Sarah Palin?
She says that Sarah Palin's success in politics is an insult to intelligent women everywhere. Sarah Palin has no principles, that Sarah Palin is a hypocrite, that Sarah Palin is vindictive. I could go on, but that's the flavor of it. And as you say, she's on the record quoted. Lyda Green suffered from breast cancer, actually had surgery, and Sarah sent her flowers when she was recovering in the hospital. But then Sarah goes on an Anchorage radio show when the hosts are saying that Lyda Green is, quote, a cancer on the state of Alaska. And Sarah thought that was hilarious. You can actually hear her on the air laughing as these shock jocks in Anchorage say Lyda Green is a cancer.
Yeah, they say it twice. You quote them as saying it a couple times that she's a cancer. And Lyda Green took offense that she was in the background tee-heeing. Another on-the-record source is a former mayor of Fairbanks, Jim Whitaker.
Correct.
What was his role? Why'd you talk to him?
I talked to him because he had been a supporter of Sarah Palin's in the early days. And in the summer of 2008, he spoke. Might have been the only Republican to speak, the only Republican office holder to speak at the Democratic convention. And why would the Republican mayor of Fairbanks, Alaska, speak at the Democratic convention? Well, because he didn't think that Sarah Palin should be a part of a national administration. He had dealings with her that led him to believe that she was a shallow opportunist and that she basically was a fraud, and that she was a poor governor. It was a danger to the Republic that she could be considered for national office. And he was one of many, many people who had been allies, still members of the same party up there, who, through personal dealings with her, revised their opinion and realized, you know what, this is just a mask that she's wearing, and behind this mask there's a very, very ugly person.
And he is one of several people quoted in the book, some of them on, some of them off the record, who talked about why her son Track joined the military. What did he say?
Well, there's a persistent story in Alaska that Track was forced to join the military or he would face jail time for vandalism. I don't say that because I couldn't confirm that because the records are sealed. But I can say that the former state director of public safety, Walt Monaghan, believes that to be true. And the person who drove Sarah and Track to the enlistment station in Anchorage the day the Track signed up for the Army reported to me that he heard a lot of emotions expressed in the back seat of that car, but none of it had anything to do with patriotism. Track had been a problem for them, a public relations problem and a personal problem, and either through strong parental pressure or under an edict from a judge, he was forced to join the Army.
And Jim Whitaker is quoted in the book telling an anecdote about when Track had come back from basic training and Sarah was talking to Whitaker, and she just kept talking, didn't want to see her son. There's Whitaker talking. I said, Governor, you need to see your son. She wouldn't do it for at least another half hour. We kept going, really just talking about silly stuff. This is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org, speaking with Joe McGinnis, author of The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. She seems to have successfully put forth this idea that her children are off limits, even though during the campaign there was scarcely a photo opportunity without her children. Do you think the media were cowed by either her definition of what isn't off limits or by some other reason, something having to do with their own definition of whether candidates' children should be on or off limits?
Well, a candidate's children should be as far off limits as the candidate wants to keep them. I think that... in the campaign of 2008 and beyond, President Obama has done a very good job of keeping his children off limits. Sarah not only makes her children part of the show, but in many ways makes the show all about them, and not just as a candidate. Look at that so-called reality show that she did last year on the Discovery Channel. Every episode involved intimate glimpses into the Palin household, she uses the children. They're the cornerstone of this false image that she's purveying of herself as a mama grizzly and as a hockey mom. She invades her children's privacy. I don't see anybody else invading her children's privacy. Her daughter Bristol goes on Dancing with the Stars. That's not a way to seek privacy. The one track has actually tried to maintain a degree of privacy, and I think everybody respects that. I certainly respect that about him. But the kids who are too young to have a choice, the Down syndrome baby and 9-year-old Piper, she's out there when the baby was still young enough to be convenient to transport. She had that baby at every stop on her book tour. And even this summer, when she did that aborted bus tour, it was Piper, the 9-year-old, who was in every picture. She puts her out there. You can't have it both ways. You can't say no one can ever talk about my children when you keep shoving the children in their faces.
You were excerpted in some newspapers in Doonesbury. Other newspapers didn't want to run the strip. Now, in the book, there's plenty of Doonesbury cartoons where the fact that you were living next to the Palins gave Gary Trudeau fodder. Recently, he was on the WNYC show On the Media, and their host Bob Garfield asked him his reaction when Doonesbury wasn't allowed to run in some of the newspapers that normally carries it.
The Chicago Tribune and a couple of other papers declined to run the strip this week because they say it does not, on fairness grounds, meet their journalistic criteria for even-handedness. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm a cartoonist, so I'm by definition unfair. I mean, that's what satire is. And for the first 25 years of my career, I was routinely thrown out of newspapers. And every editor has that judgment call to make, and I never second-guess them on that.
Okay, let's take that in two parts. I think Bob asked him, what's your take on it not being regarded as even-handed enough for newspapers? What's your take on that?
On the Doonesbury strips?
Yeah, well, on the very fact that they were excerpting your book was seen as an affront to even-handedness.
Well, I think that there could not be a more appropriate place for a book about Sarah Palin, who's basically a cartoonish figure, to be excerpted than in a series of the political cartoons by the most talented cartoonists we've had working in this country for the past 40 years. I'd also like to point out that Gary Trudeau has said in interviews that my book was meticulously reported. And I can tell you that I was in touch with him as he was preparing these strips, and we went over in great detail the stories that he was considering using. And we talked about sourcing, and he vetted this very carefully before he put things up there. And nobody has yet pointed to anything in any of the Doonesbury cartoons. And I think they're still running even this week. Nothing inaccurate.
And what's your take on some of the newspapers not running them? He says he's used to it. It's editorial.
Well, it's editorial judgment, but it's also foolish. And to apply standards of political fairness to a cartoon is really, really kind of, I don't understand it. It's just basically, it seems chicken.
Do you think she'll run?
I don't.
Do you think it's because of this book?
No. No, she has many other reasons not to run. I hope she proves me wrong, but I'm pretty convinced that she's on a celebrity gravy train right now, and there's no reason for her to jump off.
And of the reaction to the book, fair or unfair, is it doing what you wanted it to do?
I think it's unfair to comment about a book you haven't read yet. The book goes on sale tomorrow, and anybody who wants to talk about it once they've read it, anything they want to say, they have the right to say.
All right, we've been speaking with Joe McGinnis, author of The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. A portrait of her does emerge. Joe McGinnis, thanks very much.
Thank you, Mike.
On tomorrow's show, guest host Andy Borowitz speaks with Time magazine science writer Jeff Kluger about the bonds between siblings. then a look at how to make the best medical decisions in a world that's overrun with dissenting expert opinions, dueling studies, and a steady stream of drug ads. Also a look at how an ancient Roman philosophical epic on the nature of things helped invent the modern world. Plus actress Jane Lynch. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Sarah Waltuck. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I was Mike Pesca, still am, in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening.